I call Senate Resources meeting to order. This is Friday, January 26, 2024. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. Joining us today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Wilikowski, who is the vice chair, Senator Dunbar, my co-chair, Senator Bishop, and myself, co-chair, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Klayman and Senator Kaufman along soon. But we have a quorum to conduct business, and here comes Senator Kaufman. Thank you so much to Sav Danbert for being our recording secretary. Welcome, Senator Klayman. And helping us out on the audio is Susan Quigley. Thank you for your help. So today before us is Senate Bill 49. This will be a recap. We heard this bill several times last year, and subsequently several members of this committee traveled to Bismarck, North Dakota in December to participate in a meeting with the Plains CO Reduction Partnership, P-Corps Partnership. This is a partnership of 120 industry, government, and research organizations to encourage the commercial deployment of carbon capture, utilization, and storage, CCUS, as an essential technology to manage carbon dioxide emissions. Several P-Corps members already operate or participate in commercial CCUS projects across the region. That's in Alberta, Saskatchewan, North Dakota, and Montana. So P-Corps region covers a very large area. We are part of that partnership. There are 10 states in it: Alaska, Idaho, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Wyoming, and four Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan. So it's a very, very large chunk of the U.S. and Canada. Co-chair Bishop and I invited the department to come back before us today just for a refresher on the bill. And so in person, we have Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Director Haley Payne from Division of Oil and Gas, and online we have Commissioner John Boyle, and he's with DNR, and Commissioner Brett Huber, who is the chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So, also available for questions is Ryan Fitzpatrick. He is a commercial analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas. So, welcome to the table, Deputy Commissioner Crowther and Deputy Director Payne. Online, I believe the commissioner wanted to make some opening remarks. So, Commissioner Boyle, welcome. Please give us your remarks. You might be on mute.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Giesel and members of the committee. For the record, this is John Boyle, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And I really just wanted to start off by saying thank you to the committee for scheduling a time to hear this bill. As the co-chair pointed out, CCUS, I believe, is an important emerging technology, and we have seen a number of our sister states progress and take advantage of the opportunities presented by a proactive approach with creating the regulatory structure around CCUS in their states. And Alaska is certainly looking to follow in their footsteps and recognize the opportunities that exist through carbon sequestration. You know, as many of us learned in North Dakota, there carbon capture can really work well to augment and supplement our natural resource economy. And I think as Alaska looks to prepare itself for the future and to recognize the different forces at play, I think by having this legislation in place will enable Alaska to continue to look to develop its natural resources for energy, for export, for other purposes. And in effect, by having a CCUS regime in place, I feel like we'll be buying ourselves something of an insurance policy to enable that social license to let us move forward with some of that development. I think, you know, as I look at CCUS, I really see this as providing the greatest opportunities for the state for monetization. I've had a lot of conversations over the past year with different prospective developers. That includes folks that are particularly looking at producing green hydrogen, that is hydrogen that is created utilizing renewable resources, whether that's wind or solar power generation or biomass. And the one common theme amongst those developers is having a steady or reliable stream of carbon dioxide is actually really important, because as they create that hydrogen and they look to create other products from that, whether it be e-fuels or ammonia, other things like that, carbon dioxide is actually an essential component to that production. And so having the ability of having captured carbon dioxide, it's ready and available to utilize in those processes, is really important for these developers. And I think really the big opportunities that are going to exist for us are going to center around the opportunity for us to export products to Asia, whether that be hydrogen or ammonia, or hopefully in the future LNG, and then looking to backhaul captured Asian carbon dioxide that they're removing out of their industrial processes for sequestration here in the U.S. I mean, we are strategically located on the globe to offer that kind of service. We have the right rocks, as the committee may remember from our presentations last year. We have high confidence in the ability of the Cook Inlet to be a suitable place geologically and otherwise to sequester carbon. And the estimated potential that we have in that basin alone would, if you may remember the factoid, would be enough for us to capture all of Japan's emissions for the next 50 years. So there's an enormous potential there. Of course, both Japan and South Korea have signed on to the Paris Climate Accord. They've set very ambitious carbon reduction goals for themselves, but at the same time, they want to continue to grow their economies. They continue to rely very heavily on manufacturing as an important component of their economies. And so being able to offer them a place to sequester their carbon is, I think, going to be a great value proposition for the state. And as the committee also knows, we have operators here in the state on the North Slope and elsewhere that are also looking to implement carbon capture technology, whether that's direct air capture or capturing carbon through kind of existing oil and gas production. We're seeing more and more movement on that front, and of course that demand is there. And so again, having the regulatory structure in place to be able to accommodate that type of innovation and those efforts, I think, are going to be critical here as we move forward. So anyways, I know I don't have to recite all that to the committee, because I know so many of you are very much up to speed on all those issues. So I really just wanted to frame it up in terms of our gratitude on behalf of the department for you guys taking up this issue. And I've got my learned team there that will walk us through all the elements of the bill, but just wanted to open it up with that kind of high-level thoughts for me and just be here to answer any questions if need be. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that overview and your comments. Before we get started, I also wanted to make sure that your team here understood that Marwan Wortes, who is Chief of Energy Resources in Fairbanks, is also online if you need that person. So I will turn it over now to the Deputy Commissioner and Deputy Director to proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Giesel, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Crowther. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And I'll just be doing a quick overview before I turn the presentation over to Commissioner Huber of the AOGCC and Deputy Director Payne to get into the details of our refresher today. You'll see from our outline that we have a couple different key areas of updates. And the first and very exciting is that the legislature's action last year to grant authority for the AOGCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, to pursue primacy with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. The enactment of that legislation, that going into effect last year, has allowed AOGCC to do a lot of work to start conversations with the EPA over the last year. And so Chairman Huber can give an update on those discussions and what we're learning from them. We've also seen updates from other states that are actively pursuing licensing, both as to the specifics and terms that they're working with, but also the feedback that, they've received from EPA in their own pursuit of primacy. And so we're continuing to learn from our peers. Chair Giesel, as you noted, the P Corps partnership has been a core clearinghouse for that kind of information. We've developed really good relationships with other regulators in other states who are able to have those direct conversations about those updates. And then finally, we'll do a refresher for the committee about kind of the key components of CCUS projects, just to bring back that awareness and do make the sectional analysis available in the slideshow. Depending on time or the committee's wishes, we don't need to go through that in detail, but of course, if there's questions about particular sections, we can get into that. So moving on to the next slide, as the commissioner noted, this is probably unnecessary for the committee, but the core purpose of SB 49, as was originally brought forward, had three purposes. One of those was the granting of primacy, the authority to pursue primacy to the AOGCC, which has been enacted into law. So we have these two key purposes remaining in the legislation, with that overall mission of bringing our subsurface resource endowment forward for the maximum use and development. We clearly, to the benefit of Alaska, have resource development, mineral development, oil and gas development, all sorts of natural resource utilization. And we think that using our pore space to support development and industrial activity is inherent in our mission to promote that use. So this legislation would enable the leasing framework so the department can bring forward leasing, make our pore space available to operators who want to sequester carbon dioxide underground in the state resources. And then it would also provide a regulatory framework in statute for the AOGCC as it pursues that primacy, those necessary specific provisions that are needed to regulate the activity, make sure it's safe, make sure it's reliable and responsible, make sure it achieves its intended objective. And so with those two purposes, I'll move on to our last overview slide here. And this is meant to highlight for the committee that in the last year, we view it as a very positive thing. We've seen developments within Alaska on CCUS interest, efforts to characterize resources. We've seen developments nationally, which Chair Giesel, you and the commissioner highlighted, some of the work in North Dakota that members of the committee were able to see firsthand. And we've also seen a lot of corporate developments, which aren't highlighted on this slide, but you know, a quick perusal of news will tell you that different major international oil and gas companies are very actively pursuing CCUS projects, investing billions of dollars. Some of the up-and-coming and startup companies that were involved in this space have been acquired by major oil and gas companies. It's, we think, a strong indicia that those companies are going to pursue these projects in a major way. So just very quick to highlight these updates, we've talked about North Dakota being able to see some of these projects that are just starting up, so going into operations and actually completing sequestration. And I believe that was a very informative trip. The other states, pure resource states, are seeing their efforts to grant permits proceeding. Wyoming has issued its own under its primacy, its own Class 6 permit recently. And then Louisiana just last month received primacy from the EPA. And so as we go into Commissioner Huber's sections, we'll see a lot of really recent information about what the EPA is guiding and thinking in its primacy efforts, which I think has been very informative for AOGCC. And we can provide more detail in a separate or follow-up briefing for the committee, of course, if needed, but there's been some Alaska-specific developments with the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, some grants both to characterize our resources in Cook Inlet that the department is cooperating with and supporting in coordination with the University of Alaska. Different consortium of companies are looking at direct air capture opportunities in Alaska. And so we think these kinds of steps forward show us focused interest in Alaska, in addition to just this broader national and international trend of major investments. And so with that, unless there's any questions for me, I'll turn it over to Chairman Huber and provide an update on Class 6.
Yes, that's great. First, we'll go to a question from Senator Klayman.
A few weeks ago, I saw in the newspaper an article talking about carbon emissions prices dropped dramatically after 2022. And I'm just wondering, should the actual price that carbon is actually essentially the price that we would be getting for storing carbon if it has in fact dropped, is that a factor we should be paying close attention to as we consider this legislation?
Yes, Senator Klayman, I think that is a very relevant thing for the state to be tracking in the broader carbon management context. There's both voluntary and compulsory carbon markets where carbon is priced and traded. Our legislation enacted into law last year is focused on that voluntary market, some of those carbon offsets. And so that program and those projects are very price sensitive to what the carbon credits are trading at. When we're talking about carbon capture, utilization, and storage, there may be for some projects and programs active trading of those credits associated with emissions reductions. But one of the drivers is set by federal law, the 45Q tax credit. And so that is fixed in federal statute for a period going about a decade out. And so unless there's federal legislation to change that, that'll be set. And so even if there is variability in the different carbon markets that are out there for carbon pricing, that tax credit, we believe, will continue to drive these projects.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next we'll turn to Commissioner Brett Huber, who is the chair of AOGCC, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Welcome, Commissioner Huber.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon to you, to Co-Chair Bishop, and the committee members. Can you hear me okay? There was a little issue with our phone system yesterday.
It sounds great.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Brett Huber, and I serve as the public commissioner as well as the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I appreciate the opportunity always to be back with the Senate Resource Committee and to provide today an update on our efforts regarding our seeking of primacy for Class 6 wells from the EPA. So our first slide, slide 6, is something that I'm sure you're all aware. Senate Bill 48 passed last session, providing that authority to seek primacy. Also adopted a fiscal note, an appropriation of the budget for two positions, a senior carbon engineer and an assistant, as well as funds for contractual and legal support, and that's allowed our agency to get a head start on the primacy process. We appreciate that action last year. Next slide, please. Primacy has been and should be expected to continue to be a multi-year process. For states that have completed the process, the time has ranged between 3 to 6 years. We're in the pre-application phase now and have been since our initial meetings late last spring. We're aiming for 2 years to complete the process in Alaska. We're hopeful that some experience for the EPA and insight for us with the other states they've approved, North Dakota, Wyoming, Louisiana, in that order, will allow us to meet that goal. That said, we only have control over the portion of the process with EPA interaction approval entirely in their court. Next slide, same slide. I apologize for the inaccuracy in this slide. Due to the translation, I think, of the versions passed back and forth between DNR and ourselves. While the slide suggests all of the bullet listed items are cooperative state and EPA effort, the items that AOGCC and the EPA will work on cooperatively are the MOA and the crosswalk. The governor's letter and the AG statement and program description are the state's responsibility. In addition, a completed application must also include a copy of the state statute and regulations which pertain to CCUS and documentation of our public participation process. Only once we have submitted the complete package will we be considered in the application phase with EPA. You will note components of the program description are included on this slide as well. Next slide, please. Slide 8 is a brief history of AOGCC interactions with EPA pertaining to CCUS and Class 6 primacy. Interaction began with receipt of a letter of inquiry by the EPA seeking states that would have an interest in Class 6 primacy and the grant program. This letter was forwarded to me from the governor's office last January. I replied on behalf of the state with our letter of interest on January 31. Subsequently, we received notice of grant availability on November 2. So it took them a while to get the grant in place and the process in place. Following that, we attended a grant webinar on November 16th and completed our grant application in December, all of last year. We've been told that $1.93 million is allocated for each applicant state and grant awards should follow late spring or summer. I note this grant term is 5 years, indicating a protracted primacy process is still likely anticipated by the EPA. Our first meeting was with Lauren Boldrick, EPA Oil and Gas Policy Advisor in Region 10. Our kickoff meeting for our primacy effort happened following the granting of legislative authority for our agency. This meeting included the Region 10 UIC manager, as well as the DC headquarters program manager, Bill Bates, and three of his staff. At that meeting, we asked them for an initial review of the legislation for any red flags they may see for the primacy process. Their review did highlight several areas of concern, and we're working cooperatively with DNR and the GROW on potential amendments to address them. Next slide, please. Central to the primacy process is the required regulatory crosswalk comparing state statutes and regulations with the federal code. EPA authority for the regulation of Class 6 CCUS is the Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water Act. The primacy process is meant to ensure that the state is meeting or exceeding standard for the protection of freshwater drinking water and that it is demonstrated adequately in regulation. This document is expected to be several hundred pages, and this is a fairly large regulatory lift. That brings us to the areas of concern from the EPA preliminary review. The first was the good cause waivers. EPA has not granted such waivers. It is unlikely to do so in the future. The second is concerning the post-closure period regarding liability transfer process and the operation surety of financial assurance tools like a trust fund as proposed in the legislation. We've been working closely with DNR and reviewing successful applicant states' approach to recommend a path forward. We like a modified Louisiana approach as it met with EPA scrutiny and provides safeguards to the state for that period following the issuance of the closure certificate through the end of the 50-year EPA-required monitoring period. We're continuing to work on a similar approach and language for amendment. We asked for this early review to try to avoid to have to come back to the 34th legislature and ask for amendments necessary for us to move forward with primacy. We appreciate the substantial legislative time and effort that's been allocated to this issue. That said, the EPA review was noted to be cursory and preliminary, and other states and other issues could arise that need a future statutory fix. I plan to request an additional, more thorough review from the EPA as these bills continue to advance in the process. Next slide, please. I believe that we're assembling a strong team for this effort and also for the implementation of the program once we attain primacy. Our legal team consists of our dedicated Assistant Attorney General and other DOL support, as well as contracted services with Susan Pollard, formerly DOL Regulatory Section Chief, and familiar to many of you. We believe that Ms. Pollard's significant experience with Alaska statutes and regulations will be a tremendous benefit for us. Work products for this team include the EPA-required crosswalk and the memorandum agreement I referenced earlier. The commissioners and staff are leading the regulatory package development, outreach, and public participation efforts, as well as providing the technical input to the legal team. We're looking forward to adding two new hires that should round out our team for the primacy effort, as well as help lead us into the actual program implementation. We're currently scheduling interviews for applicants to the Carbon Reservoir Engineer, and reviewing applications to the recently closed carbon assistant position, and plan to have both of those positions filled soon. Next slide, please. This slide provides information on the RFI we conducted early this fall and planned RFP to come along a little later. We may desire to issue RFP sooner if we find we need additional expertise during the primacy process. We'll have a better idea of the best the most cost-effective mix of staff effort and use of consultants going forward when we fill our carbon positions. Madam Chairman, that concludes my remarks. I'm, as always, happy to take questions for you in committee should you wish, and also our agency is always available to you or any of the committee members if you have additional questions or would like to have conversations at your convenience. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Chairman Huber. Any questions from the committee for Chairman Huber? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Great, thank you. For the record, my name is Haley Payne. I'm the Deputy Director at the Division of Oil and Gas. And today I'd just like to share with you all a few of the updates that we've gleaned from other states that are starting to move forward with licensing their pore space, as well as do just a sort of brief reminder of the main components of our bill and the different phases of the CCUS projects, generally speaking. So first off, we've had the opportunity over the last year to see a number of other states who were the first movers with their legislation move forward on licensing the pore space in state lands. And it's been very interesting to see how some of the factors that we considered right away are being utilized by other states, and yet there's additional commercial terms that we had not even contemplated that are being put forward as well as a variety of different mechanisms that we were not even aware of. So the theme is that there's a lot that continues to change, and we're still learning a lot from other states as well as the agreements they reach on their own. So specifically, just taking a look at Wyoming, just in the last year, in 2003, they issued two new carbon storage leases. They actually did not move forward with a special carbon storage program. In Wyoming, the carbon storage, the pore space, is associated with a surface owner, and the Wyoming state has surface ownership rights. And so just under their special use lease provisions as a surface owner, they've moved forward. So no additional statutory things for them to license their pore space in that way. Interestingly, as there wasn't specific legislation, there was no minimums for commercial terms that had been established anywhere in statute. And so they're reaching them all through a negotiation period. And then the negotiated lease is then reviewed and approved by their state lands board before it's actually issued. So unlike DNR, in our proposed bill, they are really focused on a bonus bid payment. So what this means is that rather than taking like an annual rental, they're asking for lump sum payments at different phases of the project. And so as the project advances to different gates, they just kind of take a lump sum payment, and which is a little bit different than a rental. And then also they do have an injection charge there of $1 per ton, which they have set to the consumer price index as an escalator to account for, you know, any increases that may happen in the future. The Texas General Land Office, their legislation for carbon storage was first passed back in 2009. And when they did that, they actually tasked the General Land Office with doing a site characterization study in the Gulf of Mexico to first determine those tracts that would be suitable for carbon storage injection. That was a five-year study that they did. And so they've just in the last year begun to move forward with issuing requests for proposals based on that five-year study. And so they don't have a minimum set forth in statute for their commercial terms, but they are instead placing it within the request for proposal process. And so here on the screen, we have their recent request for proposal that went out in March through June of last year. They have anybody who is an applicant under that sale would be looking to propose something with a minimum bonus bid of $50 per acre. Similarly with the rent charge and then an injection charge about $4 per acre. They've also included an ability to capture any additional revenue outside of the 45Q. So if there were to be some sort of participation in the carbon offset, the state might enjoy some of that. And then lastly, looking over at Louisiana, similar to Wyoming, they just go under a general sort of operating agreement that's negotiated. And their lease terms, even within the state, vary quite a bit. Some leases require bonus bids, some do not. Some require rent, others do not. And the injection charges vary quite wildly. These negotiated agreements are then also approved by a board, the Louisiana State Mineral and Energy Board, before taking effect. And one of their escalators that they include is to track that 45Q tax credit that's been mentioned before. So if the federal government were to change the rate of that and increase it, the benefit in the future, their leases do capture the ability to absorb like 5 to 10% of that increased value on the 45Q. So all of this is to say there's a lot of different approaches to how these leases are being handled throughout the lower 48 at this time. And happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Director Payne? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Were these commercial terms prior to the 45Q credits, or and can you talk about how they've evolved over time if they have changed?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, for the chair. So 45Q has actually been around for quite some time. It's been recently escalated under other bills, and so the one lease that I'm aware of, there's actually, I think, one or two within Louisiana that were under the original terms of the 45Q tax credits, which I think had less generous sort of payments involved. For instance, I think the maximum value that you could receive was $55 for storage, and now it's $85 for storage. So all of these have been issued since 45Q has been in place. But I think in Louisiana, what they've done is change the escalators to be based on whatever that new 45Q portion was.
And Chair
Senator Wilkowski, oh, pardon me.
Apologies, Chair. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner for the Record. Senator Wilikowski through the chair. I just note that several of these states enacted their underlying framework legislation in approximately 2009, 2010 time period. So it's been, quote, on the books for a long time. And that framework legislation didn't set specific or minimum terms. And consequently, these agencies, as the 45Q has adjusted in recent years, have responded with different terms that they've adopted in new agreements, I think is a fair characterization.
Follow up.
Yeah, I know when we talked a few months ago back in Anchorage, there seemed to be some evolution in your thought process to how these contracts were being negotiated, and that was based in part on discussions with some of these other states. So I think as we move forward, I'd give you a little more depth on that. I'm curious, another question just on the royalty provisions. Since we have a different constitutional provision than any of these states, is there a royalty that we're requiring? Is any of the money being required to go into the permanent fund pursuant to the royalty provision of the permanent fund constitutional amendment?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. So I think in the CCUS context, we might imagine the injection charge to be the closest akin to the royalty provisions, like sort of a reverse royalty, so you're paying to put things into the ground. And we do have sections in the bill, as highlighted in the sexual summary, that show that it should be treated as any other mineral interest, so with the same payments to the permanent fund, and also having some of the same sort of accounting things in terms of, you know, when interest is charged. And so it is aligned and treated like a royalty, but we use the term injection charge instead.
Any follow-up, Senator Wilikowski? Yeah.
And so just another topic, but since the state incorporates the IRS code by reference as our own tax code, is there any concern that the state might have to pay tax credits? Has that been addressed in the House version of the bill?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, there was an amendment posed in the House Resources Committee that did, I think in their committee substitute, it was Section 41, sort of carve out the 45Q as being a part of that part of the federal code that we're adopting by regulation, thus to kind of address any concerns that you may have or that others may have related to that.
Senator Wilikowski through the chair, John Crowther here. I'd note the administration supported that change in the committee substitute, and that continues to be in the version the House is considering. We would support amendments to address it in the Senate version as well.
Further follow-up, Senator Wilikowski? I'll go to Senator Kawasaki then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have more questions about the 45Q program generally. I think Deputy Commissioner just mentioned that sort of the framework, at least the commercial term framework of 45Qs, were available a dozen years ago or so, but we're just starting to really hear about them now. Honestly, I've been on the Resource Committee for a long time, but hadn't heard about them. Is there a reason why they're being pushed so much now as opposed to prior?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki through the chair, John Crowther here, happy to offer my general characterization, which would be that the 45Q program generally has always been meant to incentivize carbon capture and sequestration. And when it was first advocated for and enacted, I believe actually with the support of at the time Senator Hovind, formerly Governor Hovind of North Dakota, who I think many view as a very forward-looking leader in the CCUS space, he saw that energy-producing states, natural resource states with coal endowments, oil and gas endowments, that the ability to manage carbon dioxide emissions associated with those would kind of prolong and expand the value of those resources. And so there was a federal effort to support that, started with the 45Q, but for a variety of reasons, it kind of started small, as one might say. And at the time, technology was very novel, it was very unsure what the right number to really incentivize projects was. So in theory, they could have passed a huge 45Q at first, but that all sorts of projects might have taken advantage of it. It might have been a huge federal budget burden. This is my characterization. I don't have a citation for this. As the industry evolved and the federal policy makers saw that carbon capture projects were developing, but the levels of initial 45Q weren't really enough to push them over the the kind of financing cost benefit hump. There was a concerted effort by industry, by different states, by stakeholders to push for expanded 45Q, and we saw that enacted in some of the federal legislation, Infrastructure Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and that was a recognition that the technology had matured, that projects were very close to coming online, and that these new $85 levels were probably the sweet spot to start getting them into development. And I think seeing the projects proceed in North Dakota, seeing the very active leasing in Texas and Louisiana is an indication that we're probably pretty close to the right level of technology, the right level of credit for things to really move. I hope that answers your question, sir.
I think so. Follow up. So there's this $85 credit, and that seems like the magic number at this point. Are the credits, are we to anticipate that this credit, this 45Q credit, will be available for a long period of time, or do we know how long that could be?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, Deputy Director Payne will probably know this off the top of her head and correct me, but I believe that if a project that begins operation by 2033 is able to claim the credit for a 12-year period at the current rate under current law. And so, as we've seen in the past, consistently this credit has been revisited, extended, expanded. So there may be federal efforts to expand it in the future, but of course there may be federal efforts to adjust it or reduce it in the future as well. So under the current law in place, there's quite a runway, but there's also that start date kind of deadline of 2033 that we want to get our framework in place so that developers can have the time to do the characterization they need to get these projects online within the next, I guess, 9 years now.
And then just sort of a thought, because Senator Bishop and I had this question earlier today about the credits that became available for wind and solar. And we've got a big project up in Fairbanks that seems to pencil out. And it seems to pencil out, I mean, quite honestly, because there's a big 40% credit there. And I'm wondering, do these just zero, not absolutely pencil out at all if there were no 45Q credits?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. My very general response to that would be the 45Q credit, we believe, is a huge driver. If you're looking kind of trade publications, they'll note that the U.S. is the massive locus of investment in pursuit of CCUS because of the 45Q being a very effective incentive. However, as Senator Klayman was referencing, there are broader carbon markets that, in theory, these offsets associated with a project could be traded on that might induce commercial success. And then additionally, different corporations for different reasons and different jurisdictions for different reasons have compelled and or encouraged carbon capture for different kinds of projects. And so those projects may still go forward under those kind of regimes, even absent a 45Q. As we've mentioned to the committee, scenarios where a carbon capture is occurring internationally and the carbon's being shipped to Alaska for sequestration, there may be incentives in those hosts or generating countries, but those would not be a 45Q-driven model, if that's helpful.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none. Before you go to the next slide, I neglected to identify Representative McKay, who has been present since the beginning. So welcome, Representative. All right. Oh, Senator Bishop has a question.
I just like to make a comment. I'm sure everybody in the committee's identified. I'm just looking under this public process, and you look at Texas, the final lease approval is the school land board. You know, that's how they fund their education system in Texas. So,
thank you, Senator Bishop. Deputy Director.
Thank you, Senator. Again, for the record, this is Haley Payne. Just be moving forward to the next section of the presentation, where we're going to look generally at the legislation and how that lines up with the various project phases in CCUS. And so advancing to slide 15, the purpose of this slide is just to sort of show generally the different phases of a project. You're going to have your exploration and delineation period, in which you then move forward to your well and facility permitting, That's the point in the legislation where AOGCC and the Class 6 primacy would begin to kick in. And then we advanced through leasing and transportation, the actual storage operations themselves, and then finally your facility closure and post-closure period. On the slide, we have noted the sections in the bill currently that address those aspects. So if you're curious about a particular phase of a project where to go, and as you'll see, sections 14 for DNR and section 31 for AOGCC tend to have a lot of the meat for the projects in general. I would note that, as Commissioner Huber indicated, that some of these sections will likely, based on feedback from the EPA, be looking to work with the committee on any amendments or adjustments to ensure that we're consistent with the EPA Class 6 primacy process now. And some of those sections might include like section 36 for clarification, as well as the facility closure period. So those have been a couple of the points that EPA would like us to update with the Class 6 rule. And we'd like to work with your committee on that.
Very good. Any questions? Seeing none?
Actually one.
Oh, Senator Klayman.
Is the EPA that's requiring additional work, is it they want us to amend the legislation to address their concerns, or is it just regulatory?
Senator Klayman, through the chair. So what we've seen is the other states that we modeled our legislation off of, they drafted theirs back in 2009, and the EPA Class 6 rule came about in 2010. And so for those states, when they were going through their primacy process, they had a very lengthy back and forth in that crosswalk period about how their regulations were going to meet it or how they were not, because the language wasn't specific. And so we think there's really an opportunity at the statutory level, as while the bill is already open, to instead of make that a back and forth through the regulation, to just clarify up front in the statute and hopefully reduce some of that back and forth in the crosswalk period, make this a bit more of an efficient process for us.
Follow up,
Senator Klayman.
So I would expect we'd see some specific requests from EPA for the committee to consider as amendments.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, I believe that the EPA has already communicated some initial feedback to the AOGCC, and it would be AOGCC and DNR that would look forward to working with the committee based on that feedback and develop any language that would be able to appropriately address that.
Good. I see no more questions.
So moving on to slide 16, there's a lot of information here, but essentially the point of this is just to kind of cover the four main authorizations that are going to occur in the bill. The two which come from the Department of Natural Resources and are going to have to do with the licensing of the state's pore space. And then there's the two for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which will really handle that subsurface component. And that's the carbon storage facility permit and then ultimately the closure certificate. I've included on here a few bullets and highlights of those, and we can look in more detail if you desire during the sectional summary. But essentially, the carbon storage exploration license is really just what grants that exclusive right to explore a particular area and do a lot of your feasibility studies and characterization work to identify that land or that particular horizon that would be suitable for injection. You get a five-year term in which to conduct this, and the conversion to a lease is based upon you actually being able to move forward on that Class 6 well permit. So that is how you can actually stopgate and move on to the next one. Moving on, the AOGCC, the carbon storage facility permit, this is where you have the site-specific information. You're talking about the exact reservoir that will be needing to go in, what those pressures would be. This is where we ensure the monitoring and bonding requirements are in line with the federal code. It also provides for the protection of other mineral interest owners and really just guides the operations over the lifetime of the project. Once the licensee has their carbon storage facility permit, their right to inject, then they get to convert to a carbon storage lease, and that grants the exclusive right to store the CO2 in the reservoir. That will include the revenue terms that the state will receive over the lifetime of those operations, and it'll take it all the way through until the operation ceases. There you go. and then finally, there's also provisions for if there is a particular reservoir right now that's being used for enhanced oil recovery, if there comes a period where the CO2 injection does no longer leads to oil recovery, and you transition from enhanced oil recovery to storage only. Our oil and gas leases do not contemplate strict storage, and so you would be required to get a carbon storage lease, and that is what this is meant to cover, is that transition from enhanced oil recovery to only sequestration.
Question, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Payne. Does a company that transfers from a Class 2 well and enhanced oil recovery well to a Class 6 well, do they get those credits too?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, there are different credit amounts for the 45Q based on what the activity is. So there is a 45Q tax credit amount that's specific for enhanced oil recovery, because inevitably when you're injecting the CO2, it is storing it along with the ability to still produce. The federal government has a lower credit amount for that than they do just for something that is pure sequestration, because they want to incentivize just straight sequestration activities a little bit more. And so yes, they would be eligible for a 45Q, and it would be at a different amount depending on if it was enhanced oil recovery or only sequestration activities.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up on that. I think it's the AOGCC, and maybe that would be something for the chairman to talk about. But, you know, utilizing every hydrocarbon or something like that is in their title. I guess at some point enhanced oil recovery is not possible, and so that's when the well would turn over. Are we anticipating right now that there's going to be Class 2 wells suddenly change over very quickly because of that 45Q credit?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. So at this time, we have not seen, looking around at other states, that any wells have fully transitioned over to it. The EPA and their Class 6 rule documents sort of discusses what might be necessary in some future time where a Class 2 well does transition over to a Class 6. But given that they have sort of very different objectives at the end of the day, it's not something that we may anticipate seeing a lot of. You know, one well is designed and wants to see more oil recovery enhanced, and one well is kind of imagining a situation where you only want to inject something. So while it's possible, it's not anticipated to be a great amount.
Thanks.
Would you like to hear from Chairman Huber if he has any comments on that?
If he's still available. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I believe he is. Chairman Huber, do you have any comments on the previous discussion?
Madam Chairman, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. Yes, we really view these as entirely different regimes, right? There's an entirely different risk profile for the CCUS as there is hydrocarbons. So again, I would agree with what Deputy Director Payne told you, and then also let you know that in the way we're looking at setting up our regulations, this isn't something that can easily go back and forth between. We have our hydrocarbon regime and those regulations, we'll have a CCUS regime and the regulations that are specific to it. So the idea of simple conversion of one well to another is not really feasible. In fact, most areas are finding that it is easier to put a for-purpose injection well for carbon dioxide instead of trying to repurpose a hydrocarbon well for that same activity.
And then
follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, is that they sort of seem in a little bit of competition in that, you know, we want oil produced, so thus enhanced oil recovery, and then I guess we also want carbon dioxide sequestered to obtain a credit, but one of them makes money for the state a lot more than the other. Is there a comment or concern about that?
Madam Chairman, through you to Senator Kawasaki, again, I would also suggest that one of them makes more money for the companies than the other does as well, right? So producing hydrocarbons is certainly more lucrative than storing carbon. Most of the cost of carbon storage, a great portion of them are eaten up in the carbon capture and transport components of carbon storage.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Huber. So back to Deputy Director.
Thank you again, Haley Payne, for the record. So the last item on the side deals with the closure certificate. And so this has to do with once all of the regulatory responsibilities are met for the Class 6 well, an operator may apply for a closure certificate to indicate that they've met those. Carbon storage is interesting in that once you stop injection, there's still a period of time under which you are required to continue to monitor. So even though there are not active operations occurring, you will need to monitor and ensure that the plume of the CO2 within the subsurface has behaved as anticipated. And so what this portion does is it says at least 10 years post-injection, or as the satisfaction of the requirements go, that you may apply for your closure certificate. This would require public notice and hearing and require the operator to demonstrate to the satisfaction of AOGCC that it has met all of those geologic requirements as well. Also included in this area is that there would be a trust fund established for the benefit of the state so that even once this post-closure monitoring period has ended, the state has an additional pot of money as sort of like an insurance policy to kind of have on file. But again, this is separate and apart from the regulatory responsibilities under the Class 6 rule.
Senator Bishop had a question.
Thank you. This is probably for Mr. Huber, but anybody that wants to take a stab at it can. Can somebody explain the mechanics to me on how we ascertain that the tonnage of CO2 stays in the pore space? So what's the mechanics of, you know, I know what the prover ball is at pump one. I know how many barrels of oil goes down the line. How do we have talk to me about the mechanics on this plume leakage.
So directing to Chairman Huber.
Madam Chairman, Co-Chair Bishop, thank you for the question. So I believe that it's a lot like we saw in North Dakota, Senator Bishop. It's really based on monitoring, right? So you're able to monitor the levels at pressure that are going down the hole. You're putting a relatively pure CO2 stream in the ground. It's really done by metering both the amount or the rate of flow and the pressure to be able to determine how much gas you're actually injecting. And that's not uncommon, right? They're looking at those same kind of things as we put out injection orders for those that are using gas lift for enhanced oil and gas recovery. So we meter those flows as well. We would do it in the same way. I hope that provides you sufficient information.
Thank you.
Chairman Huber, that must be similar to actually how they store LNG natural gas, of course, in CINGSA. Is that kind of the same principle?
So, Madam Chairman, you're exactly right. It is the same principle. And in CINGSA, they're not only monitoring the amount that goes down, but the amount that comes back to the facility, and it's done with the same type of meter.
Thank you. All right, back to you, Deputy Director Payne.
Thank you. So moving forward to slide 17, this just takes some of the same information that we saw on the previous slide and more kind of puts it on a time continuum just to show the relationship of the license from DNR to the carbon storage permit and finally to the carbon storage lease. Also, what's kind of indicated on this slide is the extensive amount of time it can take to actually get a project off the ground. From the time you go into screening into actual investment and construction. This timeline was borrowed from North Dakota, so these timelines reflect their sort of project timelines. So you might anticipate here in Alaska with our special considerations and seasonal operations that we could see these things taking a bit longer. And so as Commissioner Crowther indicated before, the kind of start date for construction in order to qualify for the 45Q tax credits is January 1st, 2033. Also kind of a subtext on this slide is really just the amount of information and data and operations and capital outlay it takes ever before you reach your operations period. So similar to an oil and gas operation, there could be hundreds of millions of dollars of CapEx spent before you ever come to a point where you're receiving those 45Q benefits.
I would just, Chair Gieslip, sorry, I'll note for the committee, Deputy Commissioner Crowther here, the Deputy Director Payne referenced it earlier in the slide deck. When Texas initiated some of its operations, it undertook work on kind of the left side of this timeline, essentially kind of investing then to increase the value of its subsurface resources. And so that's one of the dynamics that we're seeing in different jurisdictions. And as they do their lease terms, how much information they already have from different sources or how much they've invested to gather information drives some of those terms and negotiations. So in Alaska, we have a tremendous belief in our potential from our general knowledge. And that's one of the things we're working with DOE on, is to have a little bit more specific characterization, but certainly to really know specific traps, specific seals, it would take either the state or an operator significant investment. And so that's a thing we'll have to work on in Alaska for these projects to be successful, but is an important part of the timeline.
Very good. All right. I see no questions.
Okay, thank you. So this next portion is just going to be the sectional summary. And so I can kind of, there's several sections here. I'll kind of try to summarize them and highlight them, but I'm happy to slow down if there are any particular questions. So looking at slide 19, here we see some of the first sections in the bill, obviously section one just because our title. In two and three, those are the sections granting AOGCC the primacy. So obviously, as we move forward with this bill, we'll look forward to working with the committee to remove that, as that was already passed through legislation, and also just the general authority to promulgate regulations. Section four establishes that post-closure trust fund that we discussed before, that sort of acts as that insurance policy for the state. And then sections 5 through 12 really start to begin to align carbon storage with the rest of the mineral estate. So to Senator Wilikowski's question earlier, here we see carbon storage added to our sort of mineral leasing procedures, and we'll stay consistent along that as well. And then finally, sections 13, we see the prohibition in Ketchikan Bay oil and gas closure area. So this is just to remain consistent with how we do oil and gas. And there are later sections in the bill where we, again, align carbon storage locations with those that are approved for hydrocarbons as well.
Questions, Senator Bishop?
Yeah, I'm ADD. I already went to page 25. But back to section 12. And could I throw out a hypothetical?
Absolutely.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. So I'm just going to go to 3805180FF. Because carbon storage leasing might be possible on an unmineable coal seam. That I'm just going off your sectional.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I saw you looking at the notes.
Oh,
there.
I just thought I'd, you know, see if I could have the full text instead of like.
I'm not getting that technical. You don't have to. Okay. You don't have to worry about getting ahead of me. But what I want to know is hypothetically, is an unmineable coal seam in the Healy area might qualify and be under this section.
And so I believe what this section is seeking to achieve is to ensure that. Let's see. So I kind of need to actually get to my notes on that one. I would need to take a look and get back to you on that one.
That's perfect.
Okay.
That'd be great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. I see no further questions.
So moving to slide 20, not quite to 25 yet, but here on slide 20, this is really the primary section for DNR. And so here we sort of go through all of the different terms and everything that were discussed before. Essentially, this is the leasing and licensing provisions. I'm happy to go into any more detail if you would like, but this is what establishes the licensing, the work commitments, the terms for those. It also identifies the public process for carbon storage licensing would mirror that of oil and gas, where there would be an application, there would be a call for comments, there would be a written best interest finding that would have a preliminary and a final period. The department would also be required to call for competing proposals to ensure that we're getting the maximum value for our pore space as well. Also included here are similar to oil and gas provisions requiring plans of development, plans of operations, and ensuring that we are continuing to manage this in the same way that we already have experience doing for our other mineral estate. And then specifically the permanent fund question, which was asked before, is in AS 3805-735, where carbon storage leasing is added to that.
Very good. I see no questions. You can move on.
Great. So here we are on slide 21. And so this is also part of DNR's authority. We're specifically looking at our state pipeline coordinator section and adding carbon transportation pipelines to their authority to be able to regulate and manage. The state pipeline coordinator issues right-of-way leases for common carrier pipelines. They can also issue easements for those that are not common carrier. And then there's also smaller flow lines that are used within field. And so these sections talk about those sort of three different categories of types of pipelines, and note that carbon storage is now a part of, carbon transportation is now a part of our pipeline coordinator section's authority. And then it says 22 through 30, that's where you see a lot of conforming amendments. So it references geothermal. This bill does not do anything to address geothermal. It's just that for AOGCC, the carbon storage chapter is going into the same chapter as the geothermal. And so there's a lot of conforming amendments to break it into two separate articles.
Good. I see no questions.
So section 31, this is where we're getting to the primary components for AOGCC and everything that they'll need to develop their regulatory scheme in order to go through the primacy process. It talks about just their sort of general missions and authorities and the prevention of waste and seeking authority over all lands within the state, unlike DNR, who just works on state lands. And yeah, these are just sort of the general sort of authorizing provisions here up front. And then I think on the next slide, we get into some of those more specific permits. But if there's any questions on the general authorities, I'll stop.
I see no questions.
And so here in slide 23, these are the specific sections within 31 that start the different requirements for the carbon storage facility permits, the 14 different requirements that need to be met, which include the safety of the reservoir, your monitoring plans, any compensation of mineral and pore space owners. Also, our public hearing requirements. So just as DNR will have public processes, AOGCC will follow those as well. It also creates specifications so that if there is or will has ever been a carbon storage facility certificate, that sort of gets recorded as a part of the title so folks are aware of its existence. And it provides for the preservation of rights of other mineral interest owners, ensuring that their access and ability to do that is not unreasonably interfered with by a carbon storage operator.
So I have a question. How do these differ from the statutes that pertain to gas storage? We're considering, of course, natural gas import, right? And we're going to need storage facilities. So are these duplication of that? Are there distinctive features here in the CO2 storage?
And so, Senator Geisel, what I might say is, from my knowledge, that these are very similar and sort of mirror our existing natural gas process. But Commissioner Huber is on the line, and so perhaps you'd be best to speak to his authorities.
That's true. Thank you, Chairman Huber. Any comments?
Senator Chairman, I guess what I'd suggest is one of the main differences, right, with the storage facilities are really just a hold by the carbon that are being produced, then to be delivered, not some kind of long-term sequestration. Also, you have different materials, et cetera, that need to be used when you're dealing with CO2. Pure CO2 is a supercritical or as a fluid going down the hole. So those would be a portion of the differences. But as far as the operation of using a pre-existing structure in which to pump the material, that would be very similar. Regulatorily, though, we can do the storage pieces with our state jurisdiction, as we've done with CINGSA, and dealing with anything that's dealing with the straight carbon sequestration that comes under all of the Class 6 and additional EPA regulations.
Thank you, Chairman Huber. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know in Cook Inlet, is the geographical formation there susceptible to earthquakes with increased pressurization from CO2?
Senator Wilikowski, there are specific guidelines that are required in any type of this facility that would require monitoring for seismicity, whether induced seismicity or naturally occurring seismicity. I'm not aware of other areas that have had induced seismicity from CO2, from the carbon sequestration, but certainly we've had Cook Inlet in place for quite some time. We've had some major earthquakes. We've not seen any problem with any of the integrity of the seals or the formations in Cook Inlet through that process. So I don't believe it's something that we need to be overly concerned about, but there is a very robust monitoring plan for seismicity before any permits are issued.
Further questions on this page? Not seeing any. Deputy Director?
Okay, thank you. Again, for the record, this is Haley Payne, and now we're moving to slide 24. And so this is also part of AOGCC's authorities. This talks about the carbon storage facility injection surcharge. And so very similar to how AOGCC is funded now, they're funded by a regulatory cost surcharge. And so in this respect, any activities under the carbon storage permit would be collected under a fee for the actual injection charge itself. And this also covers their different penalty provisions. And I believe Commissioner Huber indicated earlier that EPA wants to see a couple of updates or clarifications to this portion as well. These were all modeled after the existing oil and gas penalty provisions, but just to be consistent with the Class 6 rule, there may be looks at amendments to here as well. And also, I think there was questions before about sort of determining the amounts for injection and storage. AOGCC would be responsible for that. And for a fee, can supply that information to folks that they would need to be able to use for their credits or other carbon management goals. So some sort of certification or certificate from AOGCC that says somebody injected X amount.
Very good. Senator Wilikowski.
We had some discussion in a previous hearing on this bill about whether or not we wanted to structure the fund in a way so that it wasn't sweepable. You have any discussion on that?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I believe there has been on the House side some revisions or amendments that were recommended to change some of the language so that it was non-sweepable. I think some of the language that was used was to set it separate apart from the general fund, but I would need to get back to the committee for more specifics on how that was accomplished.
Follow up.
Do you have any sense in a different topic, but just general sense, if the 45Q credits are worth, I think, $85, $80, what sort of, I guess, profit is being made on that? How much of that is being used to go ahead and build, monitor the formation and build the wells and everything like that? And then how much, what's the profit that companies will make on this?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So I think that profit margin really has a lot to do with specifically your source of CO2 at the beginning. The capture itself is really what drives a lot of the price. And so when you have something like the ethanol facility, which we're able to tour, and you have a very high concentration of CO2 sort of ready to go, I imagine that these can be perceived as a more profitable industry. When you have to scrub CO2 in a post-combustion sort of setting, like off a coal-fired power plant or off a natural gas plant, you're having a much lower concentration of CO2. And so that's going to eat into any potential profits. Also, that distance of transportation is going to be a huge factor as well. Again, sort of referencing the project that we witnessed in North Dakota, it was on top of its geologic storage formation. In situations, you might have to build pipelines and transport that too will get away at it. So that might be a long-winded way of saying, I guess it depends. but certainly there's a number of different stations that kind of eat into your bottom line along the way.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And I know this is trying to, you know, maybe going out a little ways, but has the Department of Revenue done any analysis on the impacts to the corporate tax structure from this bill?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I am not aware of any of that sort of modeling that has been undertaken, but we can certainly check again with the Department of Revenue and see.
Any other questions for Deputy Director Haley? I'll let you proceed.
Thank you. So turning to slide 25, this again is just some conforming language to allow or disallow carbon storage in the same areas as oil and gas, just to sort of maintain some of that consistencies. And then finally, the general authorities for adopting regulations and for providing for an effective date for the legislation. And I believe that might be our last slide here. Yes.
Well, thank you. I have a question on slide 25. So I'm looking at sections 32 to 35 DNR/parks. Mm-hmm. And of course, the first park identified and the last one are certainly executive orders before this committee that we'll be entertaining actually next week. And it removes citizens advisory committees and things like that. How does that relate here? And you may not be able to answer that. They're the governor's executive orders, but just interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, Chair Giesel, happy to speak very briefly to that. Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, for the record. The state park facilities and assets mentioned here in the bill are, you know, creations of legislative action that set aside those lands for particular purposes, the underlying kind of purpose and mission of those lands. The advisory boards that are referenced in the executive orders have an involvement in the active management of those lands by DNR, but the executive orders are focused on streamlining and bringing efficiency of those functions within the department, which is at its core tasked with managing those specially designated areas. And so this language in our bill goes to kind of the underlying statutory management of the area, which we think, you know, whether that board is in place or whether those functions are absorbed into the Department for Efficiency, this language would still guide the underlying management activity. And so that those EOs don't change either kind of the underlying statutory direction for these areas, nor how our bill would kind of bring carbon into conformance with that management. So I hope that answers your question. I know when we present to the committee specifically on those orders, when the department does, we can probably speak a little bit more detail to that.
That'd be great. Yes, that'll be next week. Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can't remember if we touched on this last year, but, you know, there are, why just those four being called out? You know, there are many other state lands and state parks. Why those four? Some permitted, some excluded. You know, Chugach State Park, for example, is not in there. So what was the thinking behind those four?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, John Crowther again here. I believe these units had particular statutory designation about what subsurface activities are and are not allowed in them that were somewhat different than kind of the general authorities, either for designated lands or for general use lands. And so we just, when we're doing carbon sequestration, it's generally available on state lands. There may be some areas where it's restricted, but we wanted to mirror the kind of particular provisions that the legislature had enacted for these four areas. We can get back to the committee if that description is not totally accurate for you, but I believe that these have kind of unique wrinkles about what is and isn't allowed in different ways or certain restrictions that are different than kind of the general authority for areas to see this kind of activity.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klayman.
But on the same topic, because I guess I'm one of many that was quite surprised by the number of executive orders that came out. And when we'll probably dig into a lot more next week, but it certainly seems if two of the four parks identified here, every areas of particular concern to make sure we're in compliance with whatever those park areas are for protection. The notion that we're proposing to take away the citizens advisory components of two of the four, that raises concerns, because I mean, I think all the state departments do a great job, but sometimes the citizens out on citizens commissions pick up things that the department doesn't. And it's just, it is quite striking that here we have this about the CCUS bill, and two of the four parks that are specifically identified in this bill are the two parks where the governor wants to remove the citizens advisory level. And I don't think it necessarily requires an answer. I think it's more for discussion, and I think we'll dig into it more next week. But it's hard to think this is just an unexpected coincidence. It seems a little bit more than that.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Can you just refresh me, because it's saying carbon storage is permitted in the Kenai River Special Management Area. What does that include, just roughly? Is that the entire Kenai River? Is it Cooper Landing down to Kenai, Soldat? What are we talking about?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, embarrassingly off the top of my head, I do not know the bounds of that unit as designated by the statute, so we have to get back to the committee.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for this update. It has been several months, so I thought it would be helpful for people to refresh their minds on it. Deputy Director, you mentioned the EPA has some suggested amendments, so we would welcome you sharing that with myself and my co-chair, and we can bring them forward to the committee, so that would be great.
Thank you.
Anything else that you wanted to share today, Deputy Commissioner, Deputy Director? Nope. All right. Great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the way you presented the sectional and identifying who had jurisdiction in the various areas. So that was really clear. So that concludes our meeting for today. Our next meeting is on Monday, January 29th at 3:30 p.m. It'll be the first hearing of Senate Bill 190. This is a big game hunting by persons with disabilities from the governor. The bill comes from the governor. There will be invited and public testimony that day, as well as an overview from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So at this time, we will gavel out. Let the record reflect the time is 4:47 p.m.